Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Didn't depress you too much by giving you a lot of financial information today about the economy, but it's stuff we all need to know, stuff we need to be advised of and be ready for, and if it's coming, why, we need to get ready for it one way or another. So thanks for listening today. You are listening to the Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network, Billy Shears, music director, and we'll join you again tomorrow. Don't forget, you heard from the radical right. Now all that's left is the truth. Later, gang.
Does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Hello, America. Welcome. Happy Independence Day. That's right. Happy Independence Day. July 2nd, 232 years ago, America declared its independence from Great Britain. And wait a minute. You're working today? You're not setting off fireworks until Friday? What's the matter with you? July 2nd, 1776, the day that John Adams wrote to Abigail Adams, will be the most memorable in the history of America, the second day of July 1776. I am apt to believe it will be celebrated by succeeding generations as the great anniversary festival. It ought to be solemnized with pomp and parade, with shows, games, sports, guns, bells, bonfire, and illuminations from one end of this continent to the other from this time forward forevermore. So get out your firecrackers. Happy Independence Day, America. Well, July 2nd is the date of American independence, even if July 4th gets all the credit. It was on this day, July 2nd, 1776, where a resolution by Richard Henry Lee, maybe someone you've never heard of, a later became a Revolutionary War general, but he had a resolution of independence that was adopted by 12 of the 13 states. New York abstained. But it was on that day that, I'm going to read it to you, the direct quote, that the resolve that these united colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved. Maybe not as ringing as the Declaration of Independence, when in the course of human events, you know, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Well, that's probably the one you've heard of. It is, of course, the Declaration of Independence that was adopted by Congress on July 4th. It was just the Declaration. The independence had already been resolved 232 years ago today on July 2nd. But if you've ever doubted that the way events actually occur can be remembered differently if you have a different reporting, just look at the fact that you're probably not going to see any fireworks tonight. One of the things I've always tried to do on the Inside Scoop is to let you know how Washington really works and not how it's been reported to have worked. And so I think it's nothing more befitting than on July 2nd, 232 years after July 2nd, 1776, to let you know what happened 232 years ago and to remind you that history is written by the victors, that reporting is done often by people with an agenda, and that even such simple things as the date America was established can get changed if you've got the right propaganda. And because the Declaration of Independence is a much more grand document than poor old Richard Henry Lee's Resolution of Independence, it is the Declaration of Independence that gets all the glory. So you'll appreciate that on Friday. You won't be celebrating America's 232nd anniversary. You'll be celebrating the 232nd anniversary of a well-written document. Kudos to Thomas Jefferson. I've been reading about the founding of America. I think that's appropriate, as July 4th is around the corner. It's sort of a separation a little bit from what we normally do here on the Inside Scoop. And yet, the Inside Scoop into America's past, again, I think has a lot of resonance for the Inside Scoop on America's present. It shows, again, how history can be changed. I was reading Richard Henry Lee's Resolution, the actual text. Very cool. You see it on the internet. I don't have the original. I'm sure it's worth a lot of money, though probably whoever would steal it from the National Archives would get in trouble. But what's interesting is there's only one word that's added in to the Resolution of Independence, and that's the word united. Apparently the fact that we would be united was an afterthought. Originally, it simply said, resolved that these colonies are of right and ought to be free and independent states. But that little addition, the word united, would of course lead to a lot of conflict in an American Civil War about 85 years or so, 87 years, I guess, according to Abraham Lincoln, 87 years later. I was reading about some of the differences between Adams and Jefferson. Now, I admit I am a Jefferson fan. Far more than an Adams fan. Jefferson, while having his problems, including sleeping with his slave, Sally Hemings, and so forth, was definitely much more of a man of the people than John Adams. I think it can be fair to say in some real sense that Thomas Jefferson is the father of the modern Democratic Party, and in some real sense, people like John Adams and, First Secretary of the Treasury, Alexander Hamilton, I think are the intellectual forebears of the Republican Party. It's interesting to note that Alexander Hamilton proposed that senators and presidents be there for life. You may not know that. Now, of course, we all know the Supreme Court has life terms, but Alexander Hamilton and the other wealthy parties of the day felt that the president should be for life, I guess like a king, and also the Senate should be for life, I guess, like the House of Lords. You know, it seems so foreign to us today, and yet when you think about it, it made perfect sense for someone like Alexander Hamilton. I guess it makes sense for the Republicans today that want to prevent Democrats from voting in states like Indiana. But I was reading how John Adams was, not real happy with the choice of Thomas Jefferson. It's just fascinating to me when we think of the founders in this very pure light. They had the same petty political grievances that, you hear people today. Richard Henry Lee had offered his resolution in Virginia. It was passed. He went to the full Continental Congress. At the time, there was opposition from Pennsylvania, Delaware, New York, and South Carolina. Pennsylvania came around. Delaware, which was really a part of Pennsylvania, just separated from it, had three delegates, one for, one against, and one was not present. And then there was the guy in South Carolina who didn't want to do it because his father told him not to. And then he made a deal with Delaware saying that, South Carolina would go in if Delaware would go in. The guy would not do what his father wanted him to do, which was to deny independence. If in return, they would wait for the third delegate to finally come in. He was suffering from cancer and asthma and rode 80 miles through the rain just in time on July 2nd to vote for independence for the state of Delaware, breaking the one-to-one deadlock. So it was not unanimous, but 12 of the 13 colonies, all except New York, did agree to independence on July 2nd. The Declaration of Independence by Thomas Jefferson, edited by committee, was adopted on July 4th, and actually New York didn't adopt the Declaration until July 9th. So nothing that important happened on July 4th. I mean, 12 colonies declared independence on the 2nd. I guess in New York they can celebrate it on the 9th. What really happened on July 2nd was after declaring independence, they had to write it all down. And here are the words of John Adams complaining about the choice of Thomas Jefferson as the scribe for the Declaration of Independence. Mr. Jefferson had been now about a year a member of Congress, John Adams writes in his autobiography, but had attended his duty in the House but a very small part of the time, and when there had never spoken in public, and during the whole time I sat with him in Congress, I never heard him utter three sentences together. The most of a speech he ever made in my hearing was a gross insult on religion in one or two sentences, for which I gave him immediately the reprehension which he richly merited. I love the petulance. It's just wonderful. He goes on to write, "It will naturally be inquired how it happened that he was appointed on a committee of such importance." You see, there was a committee of five people, John Adams, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and two others, Robert Livingston and Robert Sherman, and they were the committee chosen to prepare the Declaration. I think it was also kind of understood that maybe New York would get its act in gear and come around if everyone else sort of went through with it all. But Adams is clearly piqued that Jefferson gets to be on the committee with him. Why? Well, Adams writes, "There were more reasons than one. Mr. Jefferson had the reputation of a masterly pen. He had been chosen a delegate in Virginia in consequence of a very handsome public paper which he had written for the House of Burgesses, which had given him the character of a fine writer. Another reason was that Mr. Richard Henry Lee was not beloved by the most of his colleagues from Virginia, and Mr. Jefferson was set up to rival and supplant him. This could be done only by the pen, for Mr. Jefferson could stand no competition with him or anyone else in elocution and public debate." Isn't it wonderful seeing how petty they were, how human they were, that these great heroes actually were petty human beings? Adams talks about how what a failure Jefferson was, and he was only put in because Richard Henry Lee, the guy who wrote the Resolution of Independence, was not well-loved, and Jefferson had a handsome paper. Does that mean that it was written on really good stationery? Did he have good penmanship? I'm not quite sure. Jefferson, of course, copied a large part from George Mason's Virginia Declaration of Rights. In fact, a lot of the things that became our Constitution came from Virginia, both the Declaration of Rights and later on the Bill of Rights. It's interesting to me, of course, that the things that were changed, right? I mean, Thomas Jefferson did not get the Declaration the way he wanted it. Like all good writers, he was quite peeved by the fact that his resolution wasn't accepted in total, that there were debates over practically every section of it, and they made a lot of changes to it. As Jefferson complained, "The pusillanimous idea," pusillanimous of course means cowardly, "the pusillanimous idea that we had friends in England worth keeping terms with still haunted the minds of many. For this reason, those passages which conveyed censure on the people of England were struck out, lest they should give them offense." So apparently the original draft not only complained about King George, but the people of England as well. Jefferson writes, "The clause, too, reprobating the enslaving the inhabitants of Africa, was struck out in compliance to South Carolina and Georgia, who had never attempted to restrain the importation of slaves, and who, on the contrary, still wish to continue it. Our northern brethren also, I believe, felt a little tender under these censures, for though their people have very few slaves themselves, yet they had pretty, they had been pretty considerable carriers of them to others. Jefferson always had a kind of a mixed feelings about slavery, even though, like I said, he certainly had slaves himself, and he bedded one of them, Sally Hemings, the mother of two of his children, whom he later sent to France to be educated. From a modern perspective, we can see this as horrific. A slave must submit to her master. She certainly had no choice in the matter, and you know, one might well call it, in modern sense, rape. I certainly think it was rape when Strom Thurmond, age 23 or so, or I think he's 26, and in 1923 raped his 16-year-old maid and forced her against her will to bear his children, and of course kept that all secret. There in the 1920s, I think it's very clearly rape. In the 1700s, well, I think we're putting a little bit of a modern sensibility on it. Sally Hemings was treated better than other slaves, certainly because Thomas Jefferson slept with her, and her children, his children, were educated in Europe. Some masters had slaves that, well, they treated like slaves that were their own children. So, by today's standard, Jefferson was a horrific racist. By the standards of 200-something years ago, he was better than most. But clearly he always had a problem with slavery, and this shows how he wanted to complain about slavery in the very Declaration of Independence. And apparently those edits were taken out. Why am I going into all of this? What does this have to do with the inside scoop, with all the news the government does not want you to know? I actually think it has a lot to do with it. As we consider our independence 232 years ago. The point is that politics is messy and it's ugly. And sometimes when we celebrate its glories, and we should, I myself am looking very much forward to going out on the Mall in Washington, D.C., day after tomorrow to see the greatest fireworks display in the country. And as a Washingtonian, I can brag a little about it. Ours is always the biggest and the best. But hey, we're the nation's capital. All of you can join as well. I will certainly do that, and I will enjoy the patriotism of the moment. I've always loved my country, and I say that without hesitation. America is a great country, and I think it's important for someone like me, who is often, constantly, in fact, criticizing the government, which makes all kinds of mistakes in the executive branch, the Congress, and the Supreme Court. And you know me, I talk every day about the horrific errors, some of them criminal, that our government has and continues to commit. At the same time, I always think it's important to back up, and I think it's important on today, Independence Day, to back up and recognize how far we've come. Maybe today, if it doesn't seem a little saccharine and it doesn't seem a little maudlin, yes, I'm going to celebrate the patriotism of that I have and the love I have for my country, because we have come a long way. The Constitution, which didn't ban the importation of slaves until 1808 and didn't ban slavery until 1865, which didn't give women the right to vote until 1920 and didn't effectively give African Americans the right to vote until the 1960s. The Constitution, which didn't originally include a Bill of Rights. The Constitution, which originally wasn't so clear that we were in fact a United States. This Constitution's gotten a lot better. A lot better since it started. We have become a more perfect union. We are far from perfect. I know, I talk about that every day, as do Bob Kincaid, as does Guy James, as does everyone on the Head On Radio Network. But each and every year we become more and more perfect. And the fascinating thing for me in this election season, when I see so many Republicans challenging Barack Obama's patriotism, and I have to ask myself, what are they challenging? They can't be challenging the right of Americans to criticize and condemn their government, for that right is enshrined in the First Amendment. Indeed, perhaps the only president to put Americans in jail for criticizing the government was that old hoary, I would argue, founder of the current Republican Party, John Adams. Oh, I know they'll say it's Abraham Lincoln. I know they'll say that, and there's some historical truth to that. But America has always had a battle between the moneyed interests and the common man. And that battle began as early as the founding, between people like Adams and Hamilton on the one side and people like Jefferson and Madison on the other. And they were all rich white male property owners, at least of some Christian bent, although Jefferson was more a deist, perhaps, than a Christian. But notwithstanding all of that, there was this division from the very, very earliest time in American history, even before the Constitution, even before the first president, even in the discussions over independence, between those like Alexander Hamilton that wanted a system much more like Great Britain. And John Adams, by the way, do you know what his title was for the president of the United States? His title, this is a direct quote, this is what John Adams wanted to call the president, was, quote, His Highness, the President of the United States of America and Protector of their Liberties, unquote. Sounds pretty highfalutin. John Adams' unofficial title, by the way, was His Rotundity, which may be more accurate. The point is, there's always been this divide from the earliest times between those who represent the moneyed interests and those who represent the common man. We saw that divide right up until last week when the United States Supreme Court declared unconstitutional, an amendment by Congress called the Millionaire's Amendment. Now, this Millionaire's Amendment was designed specifically to protect everyone's right of free speech. It goes something like this. If you have two candidates run against each other for public office, normally they have to, if they accept public funds, they can only get $2,300 per person if they're running for Congress or most any federal office. But the United States Supreme Court held in 1976 an opinion that I think is suspect, but definitely good law. Well, good law in the lawyer sense. In other words, it is the law. It might not be a good law. That's kind of a strange term now that I think about it, good law. Good law to a lawyer means it's actually law. It doesn't mean it's a good law. But the actual law is that you can spend unlimited amounts of money of your own wealth on your own campaign. And that's been the law since the Buckley v. Valeo decision of 1976. The idea is if you're a multi-billionaire, you can spend multi-billions of dollars on your campaign. And people like Michael Bloomberg, who never ran for public office before, can become mayor of New York just because he can spend and spend and spend and spend and fill the airwaves and become mayor. Now, if you're not a millionaire, well, you're under restrictions. $2,300 a pop. And those restrictions, if you're not a millionaire, make some sense. The idea is that you don't want a few millionaires or multimillionaires controlling you. Right? I mean, there's a reason why we have public financing laws. There's a reason why we have restrictions to $2,300 per person. And the reason for that is quite simple. We don't want Tammany Hall. We don't want rich bosses of corporations or other moneyed interests controlling our politicians. Now, I know they do, but hey, we were trying to stop it as much as we can. So public financing and financing restrictions generally make sense. And if you could only raise $2,300 per person, which is still a hefty amount. I don't know how much you've given to a political campaign, but the most I've ever given, and I consider it quite a lot, is $200. I think that was a lot. And I could afford it. But so there are not too many people, I think, that are maxing out at $2,300. But in any case, that's the limit, that's the law. Well, Congress decided in its wisdom, and guess what? This time I think Congress was wise. In an amendment to the McCain-Feingold law, that the $2,300 a person makes sense if the candidates are about equal wealth. Then they can raise as much money as they can from as much supporters as they can, and they can compete based on their level of support. But what happens when you have a multi-millionaire running against someone of very little wealth at all? What do you do then? Well, there's a problem, because the multimillionaire can spend gobs of money. Gobs is a legal term. It means tons, junk loads, huge barrelfuls, tens of millions of dollars, whatever, lots of money, and it's just because the guy's rich, not because he's popular. I mean, imagine you have, let's say, Mother Teresa running against, Kenneth Lay of Enron. And Mother Teresa is well-loved. She's loved by 1 million extremely poor people. And each of those 1 million extremely poor people give her $1, it's all they can afford, to elect Mother Teresa a member of Congress. Kenny Lay is loved by virtually no one. He's someone who manipulated the prices of electricity at Enron and padded his pockets with billions of dollars that he stole from people buying electricity. So he takes $100 million of his own cold cash and plunks it down. Now, how many people love Ken Lay and want to see him as president? One, just Ken Lay. He plunks down $100 million. How many people want to see Mother Teresa win? Let's say there's 10 million poor people each giving her a dollar. She's got $10. $10 million. So the candidate with 10 million supporters has $10 million, and the candidate with one supporter has $100 million. Now, you can fix this system slightly. You can tweak it without taking away the right of a multimillionaire to spend as much money as he wants or she wants, usually it's a he, on his own campaign. Congress found the way to do so without violating the 1976 Buckley-Vivaleo decision. Here's what they said. It was actually kind of ingenious. If you have someone spending more than $350,000 of their own money more than the other candidate, so just to make it easier to talk about, let's say $1 million, round million. Let's say you got a candidate spending $1 million more than the other guy of his own cash. Then the non-self-financing candidate, who doesn't have $1 million to throw on his own campaign, can raise more money with greater limits for the others who give it to him. So instead of $2,300 being the limit, it's tripled to $6,900, so around $7,000. So the rich man who spends $100 million of his own money can raise additional money at $2,300 a pop. And Mother Teresa, who has only $10 million, can raise money at $7,000 a pop. And that helps equalize it a bit. And actually, when you have the non-self-financing candidate raise enough money that he gets close to the rich candidate, then the added benefit ends. And the non-self-financing candidate, the poorer guy, or Mother Teresa in our example, has to abide by the same limits as the rich guy. Think about how brilliant a solution this is. It doesn't in any way inhibit the power of the rich person to spend as much as he likes to promote his candidacy. All it does is it takes the man who doesn't have as much wealth but has more support to help that person raise a little bit more money to somewhat equalize the difference. The United States Supreme Court, by a vote of 5-4, with the typical four in the majority, the typical four in the minority, and Anthony Kennedy swinging the wrong way, the United States Supreme Court last week declared the Millionaire's Amendment unconstitutional. They said that for a rich man to have to endure the free speech of a poor man was unconstitutional. You see, you have a constitutional right, the Supreme Court said, if you're rich, to have more speech than if you're poor. If you're poor, you only get so much speech. I mean, whatever, you know, you got $1,000 to spend, okay, you can get a few flyers out. Maybe you can go and picket the Supreme Court with your little sign. And if you've got $10 million, well, you can have maybe $100 million, a wall-to-wall presidential campaign with ads and flyers and TV commercials and, hey, product placement wherever you want it. And the Supreme Court said that if you allow the poor man to raise more money, more than the rich man can raise, not more money, that's always hard explaining these things to people. Again, the rich man has $100 million, the poor man has $10 million. The rich man can still raise money at $2,000 a pop. The poor man can just raise money at $7,000 a pop. And if he gets ever close to the rich man's $100 million, then he loses that right to get the extra money. So you see, all that the rich man suffers is his opponent gets to somewhat close the difference, the unequal difference in their wealth in terms of speech. It's a brilliant solution. I have always learned that the way you fight speech you don't like is with more speech. That is what the First Amendment is all about, I thought. The reason why the Nazis are allowed to march in Skokie, where there are lots of Holocaust survivors, the reason why the Ku Klux Klan can get out there in their white robes and preach their ignorant hate, is because when the 10 Klansmen get out there in their robes, we can then bring a good 10,000 good American citizens, white and black, anti-racist, to have a counter-rally against the Klan and show them to be the ignorant, hateful rubes they are. Speech fought by speech. But for the first time in American history, the Supreme Court has held that if you're rich, you shouldn't be able to allow a poor person to speak against you, you see. See, if you have $100 million and your opponent only has $10 million, you should get 10 times as much speech. It's only fair. $1, one speech. $10, 10 times as much. And it's unfair and wrong and unconstitutional, even though Congress passed the law, the judicial activists on the Supreme Court overthrew that congressional law, which merely said that if you're not as rich as the other guy, you could raise a bit more money to try to close the gap. It's really scary when you think about it. I mean, the rich candidate, Jack Davis, who sued, was complaining about unequal treatment. And his complaint was, look, I put in $100 million of my own dollars. Again, the numbers don't matter, so I'm just using that as a constant example. I put in $100 million of my own dollars, and he only put in $1 million of his dollars. And when that happens, I should be able to raise money only at the same rates as he does after our initial disparity. You got it? It's a little confusing, I know. By the way, if you have questions about any of this, call in, because I know it's confusing. 877-4HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. But what Jack Davis argued is, hey, I've got $100 million, and I purchased for my campaign, and my opponent has only $1 million. I need to maintain that $99 million advantage. Why? Because I'm rich. And it's unfair and wrong and unconstitutional of Congress to restrict my speech, Jack Davis argued, by allowing someone else to speak. Jack Davis actually had the audacity to argue, and Sam Alito, Justice Alito, agreed with him, as did five members of the Supreme Court. He argued that if someone else, my political opponent, is also allowed to speak 1/20th as much as I am instead of 1/40th as much as I am, that's harm on my speech. Don't let someone else speak because that harms my speech. It's ridiculous. No one was restricting Jack Davis. He could spend as much as he wanted. All the Millionaire's Amendment allowed the non-self-financing candidate to do, the poorer guy to do, was raise money at greater rates to help equalize the difference. But this is a court that is in the tradition of Alexander Hamilton, that rich guy from the West Indies who wanted to help promote the rich, in that tradition of John Adams, in that tradition of the moneyed interests who 232 years ago, frankly, were less trusting of the people than some others. So these things happen today as they happened then. Toll-free number, 877-4HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. If you want to comment on my little historical lecture, you're welcome to do so. Otherwise, there's plenty of news of the week. Call in. Let us know what you think. We'll be right back after this.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Obama's making me more nervous by the day. After last week's capitulation on FISA and his endorsement of capital punishment, I wasn't sure where he'd retreat to next. But now I know. Straight into the church, where he's seeking asylum for ever having been or been viewed as a progressive. On Tuesday, he endorsed a version of Bush's faith-based initiative. He even borrowed Bush-like language by downplaying the role of government. The challenges we face today, Obama said, from saving our planet to ending poverty, are simply too big for government to solve alone. But rather than using taxpayer dollars to do the work of government, he, like Bush, will be funneling those dollars to religious groups to do their own thing. Oh, I know, Obama assures us that the money this time won't be used to proselytize and that the churches, synagogues, and mosques won't be able to discriminate against prospective employees on the basis of their religion. But at bottom, Obama's faith-based initiative, like Bush's, will amount to a government subsidy for religious groups. If you give a church a $1 million grant to cover a program it's already running, that frees up $1 million for that church to go find converts. Is that really what our tax dollars should be doing? There is such a thing as the First Amendment's Establishment Clause, after all, and Obama waved at it right before he ran it over. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95.
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
From Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. Happy Independence Day, everyone. July 2nd, of course, the date when 232 years ago, America first had its resolution of independence when the United Colonies, and United was added at the last minute, but the colonies declared themselves free and independent of Great Britain. The great Richard Henry Lee had his resolution granted. And most Americans have never heard of him. And most Americans celebrate the day after tomorrow. History is written by the victors. Never forget that. History is written by the victors. It's also written by people who simply are recalling the history they've learned. That's what's so fascinating about history. That's why I love history so much. Because it's like the old philosophical question, if a tree falls in a forest and no one's around, does anyone hear it? Does it make a sound? Did it really fall? If something happens in government and the newspapers don't report it, did it really happen? I mean, when I got into radio 5 years ago, a couple weeks ago, it was my fifth year anniversary, I felt that same deja vu. Here it was that I was sitting on the Department of Homeland Security committee, the committee that oversees that department in the House, and there weren't many people there, and it was a, you know, summer day, and there was no press in the room, and that's when I heard Paul Redmond, the guy in charge of all bioterror attacks against the United States, tell the chairman of the committee, Republican Chris Cox, that he was the only guy in America looking at bioterrorist attacks, because actually all the attacks were funneled in through the Bush secret government, through an organization called TTIC, the Terrorist Threat Integration Center, set up by secret executive order without telling Congress, and they had 10,000 people working on threats there, or so. I don't remember the exact numbers. I do remember that Paul Redmond was working alone until 3 days later when he was fired. Oh, excuse me, resigned for health reasons. He looked fine to me. But it wasn't reported. It wasn't in the New York Times. It wasn't in the Washington Post. Heck, the only person who reported it was me, Mark Levine, host of the Inside Scoop. Now, I'm not trying to put on airs here, but I wasn't the only person in that room. True, it was mostly empty. True, only about a third of the committee was there. True, there were maybe only 10 people in the audience. And true, Paul Redman was fired, resigned for health reasons, 3 days later. But the minutes are there. I mean, I'm not crazy. You can look it up. You go look for a hearing in June of 03 of a subcommittee of the Homeland Security Committee. And there it is, Paul Redman's testimony recorded in the minutes. It was a public hearing. But TTIC has gotten very little public attention. If a reporter isn't in the room, maybe the event didn't happen. Well, of course the event happened. But if there's no one there to record it, it won't be remembered in history. The same is true with July 2nd. Oh, there was a resolution of independence. It's recorded. It's there in the books. But if historians talk about July 4th, and if we go out and celebrate and have picnics every July 4th, which I plan to do, along with most of you, then who will ever learn the truth about July 2nd? And in some instance, it doesn't really matter, right? July 2nd, July 4th, yes, it's America's birthday. I mean, you think that would be something you'd want to teach little children, but the other day, it's just a date. It's just a date. George Bush creating a secret government to hide evidence of terrorist attacks so that he could use them for political purposes, that's more important. But you probably haven't heard about that either, unless you are a regular listener of the Inside Scoop. You probably haven't heard about that either. Now, maybe you all know about July 2nd. I got to tell you, I was talking with Agnes Kincaid right before the break. I told her Happy Independence Day, and she didn't blink an eye. And I tried again. I said, Happy Independence Day, July 2nd. And Agnes, in her wonderful way, said, I know, honey. I'm like, okay. I can't put one over on Agnes Kincaid. She knew about July 2nd. And many of you do, I'm sure, as well. But my point is, it's a very small minority of Americans. And it's always been such. Whether from July 2nd on through all of the things the Bush administration has kept hidden. And let's face it, they're not the only government that's hidden information from the American people. They are the worst. But all you have to do is look at things like the Gulf of Tonkin incident that led us into the Vietnam War, or the fact that a boiler blew up in the USS Maine causing the Spanish-American War. Governments have used disinformation for a long time. As I pointed out, John Adams is the only president to actually imprison Americans for spreading, well, I don't know if they're false or true, spreading information that was against the government. One of the reasons why I can never respect John Adams, in fact, is because of this. It was called the Sedition Act, passed by the Federalist Congress after George Washington was no longer president. During John Adams' presidency, they literally rounded up people who spoke against the government and put them in jail. Indeed, if Thomas Jefferson had not won the quite difficult and contested election of 1800, I wonder what would have happened to America. I've been praising Jefferson a lot this hour, haven't I? I admit he had his faults. But Jefferson understood that criticism of the government is an absolute right of every American citizen. It is not only a right, my friends, it is a duty. I want you to think about that this Independence Day as well. To blindly accept what the government tells you is, my friends, the most unpatriotic act you could ever have committed. That is largely the act of the Republican apologists, the Rush Limbaughs of the world, the ones who would suggest that the government never does anything wrong, that whatever Bush says is right, Heil Bush. But Jefferson understood, unlike Adams, that those of us that condemn the government do so because we love our country. And indeed, let me suggest, that those of us that condemn our government love our country more than those that accept what our government does without question. Take that, all of you who would challenge Obama's patriotism on the right. All of you that would blindly accept what the government tells you without demanding that it be put in public. Those of you that accept secret government and secret prisons and secret wiretapping and secret trials and secret torture, you don't love your country. You don't love your country at all. You hate America. Because if you believe in a secret government, an all-powerful government, in a government under the unitary executive theory, as described by my evil classmate at Yale, John Yoo, and Dick Cheney, the vice president's former chief of staff, David Addington, in a recent hearing before Congress, if you believe that the president is all-powerful, if you believe, like John Yoo, that he can unilaterally and secretly remove himself from the law, then you believe that we have a president that has more power than King George III. Even King George III, by 1776, had to submit some of his authority to Congress, to the Parliament, the British Congress. So those that accept without question their government, no, they don't love America. They don't understand America. They might love East Germany. They understand nationalism. They would do very well in Nazi Germany, in current-day China, in the former Soviet Union, in Saddam Hussein's Iraq. It's very easy to toady to the ruling class. And in fact, it's often very lucrative. Look at all the telecommunications companies that did what the administration asked them to do. Quest said no. Quest lost government contracts. Halliburton says yes, 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 yes. And they not only get government contracts, but they get them way out of proportion to what things cost. Literally, they line their pockets with gold. It must be a lot of gold, because we know they lost billions of dollars in walking around money in cash in Iraq. So it will always benefit people, always, to support the government. And if you have reasoned and looked at all the issues and you've determined for yourself that the government is always doing what you think is right, you're a rare creature. But you have that right. You have the right if you've submitted it to reason and logic. I don't know how you possibly could. But you have that right as an American. But let me suggest to you, a real American never accepts everything the government does that's right, whether the government's Republican or Democratic. Because if you're a thinking human being, you're going to understand the government does some things right and some things that aren't right. And that's who America is all about. This Independence Day, that's always been what America is all about. Criticizing. Petitioning your government for redress of grievances. Challenging. Electing someone who has a different view. That's what America is all about. So when Barack Obama wants change, it doesn't make him less patriotic. It makes him more patriotic. Those that don't want change, after all, I'm sure supported King George III. One of the other things that historians don't usually get it wrong, but people who think they know history get it wrong, is talking about the First and Second Amendments to the Constitution. When the United States Supreme Court, for the first time in 217 years, got to do math quickly, since the Bill of Rights became part of the Constitution, when they, for the first time, said the Second Amendment's got nothing to do with militias. Nothing whatsoever to do with militias, even though, well, the whole first clause talks about a militia, right? I mean, the amendment begins, a well-regulated militia necessary to the security of a free state. But when the Supreme Court held that the Second Amendment had nothing whatsoever to do with militias, that whole part of it was just kind of a nice irrelevant phrase that Scalia seemed to find, he talked about how the Second Amendment was so important. So important, second only to the first, the great First Amendment that protects freedom of speech and freedom of religion and freedom of the press. And it's the guns, the second only to the first. It's that important. Does Scalia know nothing about history? Because the First Amendment wasn't the First Amendment to the Constitution. It was the Third Amendment. And the Second Amendment was the Fourth. There were two that weren't adopted. They were adopted by Congress, but they weren't ratified by the states. One had to do with representation. The other had to do with congressional salaries. And it wasn't adopted until 1990-something, our most recent amendment, the 27th Amendment, the one that says that you can't increase your own salary until you have another election. That was number one. So the great idea, I mean, look, I like the First Amendment as much as the next guy. But the fact that it is our First Amendment, pure historical accident. It was supposed to be the third. And the Second Amendment was supposed to be the fourth. And if you really think that freedom of speech and freedom of religion and freedom of the press is the most important, and I grant you there's reason to think that, and if you think that guns is the second most important, which I've got real problems with, then you must think the Third Amendment is the third most important. And that's the one that says that they can't quarter soldiers in your home. That's the part of the Bill of Rights that you've never heard of. Probably. Most lawyers have never heard of it. And that's more important than the Fourth Amendment, which prevents his unwarrantless searches and seizures? Really? I'd rather have a soldier quartered in my home than all of my private papers searched by some bureaucrat. I mean, I don't know. Maybe the soldier's cute. In any case, the point is very clear. If you misuse history, you can use it for your own agenda. And by saying the First Amendment is the greatest and the Second Amendment is the second greatest, it sure sounds good on paper. It just happens to be false. And one of the joys of debunking historical myths, as I'm doing today, is I think it makes clear that we have to make clear that the history of today is written correctly in the future. There's a reason why we're not shooting fireworks off today, because the Declaration of Independence was more elegant than the Resolution of Independence 232 years ago today, and the Declaration of Independence was published on July 4th. There's a reason why most Americans today don't question the fact that George W. Bush became president in 2001. They assume it was lawful largely because so few people complained. The historians don't use the word coup d'etat. They use it in other contexts and talking about other countries, and Chile and Iran and Mexico and other historical coup d'etats. They don't ever mention the 2000 coup d'etat. In December 2000, when Justice Scalia said, "No, no, don't count the votes. If you count the votes, you'll find out that somebody else won. We can't have that." History is written by the victors. Just as today people think that America had its independence on July 4th, just as today that people think that the First Amendment to the Constitution was the First Amendment adopted by Congress to the Constitution, there will be people that talk about George Bush winning the election of 2000. It's going to be in your history books, my friends. That doesn't make it true. But it's going to be in your books, mark my words. The history books will talk about the treason of Aaron Burr and his treason trial, vice president under Thomas Jefferson, in the early first decade of the 1800s. They won't talk about the treason trial of Dick Cheney. It won't be in your history books. That doesn't mean it didn't happen. It just means it won't be in your books. Tree falls. No one reports it. It didn't happen. Just as my inside scoop on how George Bush is setting up a secret organization to trick us on terrorist attacks won't be in the history books either. One more thing I want to say, and it's kind of off theme, but I'm going to take issue with Matt Rothschild, as I sometimes do, as I often do. It's suggests that Matt Rothschild knows nothing about the faith-based initiative. I strongly support Obama's faith-based initiative, and that may surprise you. It may surprise you because probably the most single successful act I did when I worked in Congress was defeat George Bush's faith-based initiative, something I'm extremely proud of. I mean, I worked on lots of things. Heck, I worked on the Patriot Act. But this is the one that had my fingerprints biggest on it, my John Hancock, if you will, to use the founder's analogy. I really helped kill that. There were others. I'm not going to claim I did it alone. But I went door to door as a member of a staff of a high-ranking judiciary committee member of Congress. And I went door to door, senator to senator, and convinced them one by one by one not to support George Bush's faith-based initiative. Because I told them, it's all a ruse. It's all a trick. You see, the government, like it or lump it, has been giving money to religious organizations for charitable work for 50 years. Ever since, 45 years. Ever since the 1960s, the government has given money, grants, to Catholic Charities, to Jewish Federation, to United Methodists. And those monies have gone for many good programs. And all of those programs were, under federal law, required to serve everybody. You don't have to be Jewish to go to Federation. You don't have to be Catholic to go to Catholic Charities. They were required not to proselytize, right? They can't do as the Salvation Army does and say, you want to eat that, hungry person? You want to eat that? Pray to Jesus first. Here's the prayer. Say it or starve. You couldn't do that. And you had to hire anybody. So, yes, there are Christians working for Jewish Federation. Yes, there are Buddhists working for United Methodists. Yes, Catholic Charities hires the one that's best able to dish out the food to provide the drug rehabilitation service. That's been going on for 50 years. That really is not very controversial. If you disagree, let me know. But I don't really have a problem with that. Religious groups and non-religious groups could compete at an equal level. And as long as the religious groups didn't proselytize, didn't use the money to promote religion, and hired everyone and served everyone, well then, heck, they should be able to do it just like anybody else. I don't have a problem with that. And I don't understand why Matt Rothschild would have a problem with that. And I know Obama doesn't have a problem with that. Lot, great question in the chat room. I'll get to you in a second. I promise. I'll have to go quickly. The problem with Bush's faith-based initiative was that he wanted discrimination. He wanted to change this 40-year-old practice and say that Catholic Charities could only hire Catholics, and Jewish Federation could only hire Jews. And you know what? Catholic Charities didn't want to only hire Catholics, and Jewish Federation didn't only want to hire Jews, but the Salvation Army didn't want to hire gay people, and they only wanted to hire Christians, and in fact, the black Muslim groups, the Nation of Islam, only wanted to hire Muslims.